I probably was off key. Apologies. My four ears. I'll blame it on my four ears. Let's open our Bibles again to John chapter 21. Now, there isn't a book in the Bible that hasn't been preached on more from this pulpit than the Gospel of John, and I dare to enter that territory. Indeed, it only seems like yesterday, doesn't it, when Gerard preached from this very chapter. Was it the second Sunday in the year? January 11th? I can't remember. But anyway, January. And he preached a sermon entitled, The One Question We Must Answer. And his focus fell on verses 15 to 17. Comforting and also a challenging sermon. Well, we're going to be giving our attention to what precedes what Jesus said, or rather, what precedes Jesus' exchange, all right, with Peter. It wasn't only Jesus who spoke, Peter also spoke too. But we're going to be giving our attention to what precedes that exchange in verses, 15 on to 17. Jesus says more after that. We're going to be focusing on the first 14 verses of John chapter 21, page 907. I didn't mention that. Now, where do these verses fall? Where do they fit into Jesus' earthly life and ministry? He's above now, all right? Where do they fit into that 30, 33 years of life? Jesus has died. Jesus has been buried. I'm speaking from the perspective of the time, all right? Jesus has died. Jesus has been buried, but Jesus has risen. He's still to ascend to heaven. We're in that 40-day period between the resurrection and the ascension. When exactly did what we read in verses 1 to 14 happen in that 40 days? Well, it could be in the second week, the third week, maybe the fourth week. We don't know. What we do know is that it's probably soon after the second appearance of Jesus to his disciples. This is the third appearance. We'll look at those verses shortly, all right? We know that from what John says. But what I do want you to notice, we don't need to know the exact timing. What I do want you to notice is how the chapter starts, because it is significant. Verse 1, after this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and notice these words, he revealed himself in this way. Let me repeat all of that. After this. That's after what's described in chapter 20, verses 26 to 29, more specifically. That's after the previous post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to the disciples. After that, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. Note the repetition of the word revealed. John, the Apostle John, and the Spirit of God in him appear to be making a point. Indeed, this 14-verse section cannot end with exactly the same word being used again. Look at verse 14. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. John isn't simply recording another appearance of the resurrected Jesus to his disciples. John and the Spirit of God in him are also concerned about the way Jesus revealed himself. Appeared. Other versions have showed himself. Convey exactly the same meaning. John and the Spirit of God in him are also concerned not just simply with Jesus revealing himself, but going back to verse 1, all right, but about the way. Three times we have the word revealed. In one instance, we have these words, and he revealed himself in this way. All I want to do this morning is ask and answer one question, and it's this. How does the risen Jesus reveal himself? How does the risen Jesus appear to his people, reveal himself to his people? How does the risen Jesus show himself, if that's what's in the version on your lap or in your hands? It's a simple question. How does the risen Jesus reveal himself, appear to his people? And what I want us to see are a number of general principles in the particular instance that we have in John chapter 21, verses 1 to 14. Because this isn't the only post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to his disciples, or to anyone else for that matter. And so I'm going to be very careful how I express myself. I don't want to absolutize what we see in our passage. What it describes isn't the only way Jesus, the risen, the resurrected Jesus, reveals himself, present tense, reveals himself to his disciples, meets with his disciples. But at the same time, I don't want to downplay what we see in our passage. John and the Spirit of God in him are quite obviously making a point when they say, and he revealed himself in this way. There's a clustering of this word reveal in chapter 21 that you do not find elsewhere in the book of John. I'm not saying that the word does not appear elsewhere, but three times in the space of 14 verses, and then this small phrase, this way, we're to be seeing something. Noticing something. It's a way, all right? And he revealed himself in this way. It's a way that is continually repeated in the scriptures and in life. Indeed, the other post-resurrection appearances of Jesus confirm most, if not all, of what we will see in our passage. Indeed, I hope, brothers and sisters, we will be saying amen. Not necessarily verbally, audibly, but a hearty amen by the time we're finished. So, how does the risen Jesus reveal himself? I'll stick to that word, what our ESVs have in them, rather than show or appear. How does the risen Jesus reveal himself to his people? Well, first of all, he often first appears unrecognized. Seven men are out on the water. That's Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, and two unnamed disciples. Two unnamed disciples, representative, dare I say, of the invisible rank and file of the church, which is as much a part of her backbone as the named and the known are. All seven men have been out on the Sea of Tiberias. That's the Sea of Galilee, as we more commonly understand it, the Sea of Tiberias, or the Sea of Galilee, depending on whether you use the occupiers, that's the Roman name for it, or the native name for it, Galilee, the Sea of Galilee. Well, they've been out for an entire night, or the better part of a night. But verse 4, just as day was breaking. In other words, the sun had risen. All right, the sun had risen above the mountains to the east of the Sea of Galilee, the Transjordan range. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus was there, standing on the shore. Was he on that side? Doesn't matter. He's standing on the shore. The disciples can see someone. They can see him. But they did not recognize him. How did Jesus appear to Mary Magdalene on the first Resurrection Sunday? Mary didn't recognize him. She thought he was the cemetery gardener. How did Jesus appear to those two disciples on the road to Emmaus? They didn't just not recognize him. We read that he hid himself from them. They only recognized who he was later, when with other disciples gathered together, he broke bread. I repeat the question. How does the risen Jesus reveal himself to his people? Secondly, he often reveals himself during the course of normal, mundane life. Normal, mundane life. What were the seven men busy doing? They're fishing, verses 2 and 3. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We will go with you." They went out and got into the boat, and I'll stop reading there. All right, the last words of verse 3 offer another separate point. But for the moment, the men aren't doing anything special. Note that. They aren't at a special meeting. They're not on a retreat. They haven't taken monastic vows or moved out into a desert cave. Fishing was how they put food on the table before they went and spent 3 years in what we could call Jesus's residential college for apostles. They're simply out doing their regular day job again. I repeat the question. How does the risen Jesus reveal himself to his people? Thirdly now, he often, He often reveals himself during the course of normal, mundane life when things aren't going so well. Normal, mundane life when things aren't going so well. The end of verse 3 now, what I didn't read. But that night, they caught nothing. When things aren't going so well. Now, without at all suggesting that catching nothing was a condition for the Lord revealing himself, it was in such a situation that the Lord appeared. Unrecognized, but still there. Our pennies starting to drop. You see, it wasn't just within normal daily life that Jesus appeared, but in unproductive and frustrating and disappointing daily life. Back to the question. How does the risen Jesus reveal himself to his people? Fourthly, he often reveals himself where we have been told to be. He often reveals himself where we have been told to be. The words of verse 1 are significant. All right, the words of verse 1 are significant. We rewind. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples where? By the Sea of Tiberias. The risen, the resurrected Jesus often reveals himself where we have been told to be. They are exactly where they had been told to be. The Sea of Tiberias, the Sea of Galilee, that's where the disciples had been told to go by Jesus. Now, we're not going to turn there, but you can take down these references to check me up. Matthew 28, verses 7 and 10, and Mark 16, verse 3, tell us or record Jesus' command, go to Galilee. The issue is this, the disciples are where they had to be. Where they were to wait, where they were to wait to meet Jesus. Who likes waiting? Who likes waiting, especially when something exciting is up? Who likes waiting when something exciting is up, but there's nothing but the mundane to do? Then, who likes waiting when something exciting is up, but there's nothing but the mundane to do, and then the mundane yields nothing? But that night, they caught nothing. What's your Galilee? Where has the Lord put you to wait for him? And nothing appears to be happening. Indeed, things aren't going to plan. Where is he? We ask. Back to the question. How does the risen Jesus reveal himself to his people? Well, fifthly, he often reveals himself when we simply obey. When we simply obey. Obey who, we might ask? Obey doing what? Look at verses 4 to 6 again. Just as the day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." Now, to be clear, the disciples hadn't recognized Jesus, not at this point. They're still to have recognized that Jesus is the one standing on the shore. They didn't know who it was that was telling them to cast the net on the right side of the boat. Just a little aside. But neither do we recognize Jesus' voice, do we? Neither do we recognize Jesus' voice in the good sound advice or the commands that he sends through others. Advice and commands we wonder at. But back to the text. Why did the disciples listen to the stranger on the shore? They didn't know it was Jesus, but they listened, didn't they? May I suggest two things? In the first instance, at least, may I suggest that they were simply, or rather, they simply and respectfully obeyed the advice of someone they took to be senior to them. He called them children after all, didn't he? In his early 30s, but perhaps hazy enough, opaque enough, the view of him, they couldn't quite work out his age, but in the first instance, were they perhaps simply respectfully obeying the advice of someone they took to be older, senior to them? Children, he says. But I'm going to suggest something else. I'm going to suggest they were also, in the second instance, respectfully obeying the advice of someone who spoke with a calmness and an authority that was simply persuasive. Simply persuasive, despite the unexpected nature of the command. And the command is odd, after all, isn't it? And it's when they do that, simply respecting someone who's older, senior to them, and someone who's speaking with an authority that can, and we know what that's like. How many of us, on the other end of the extreme, I'm not talking about Jesus here, somebody tells us to do something, we do it, and then we realize how stupid and silly we have been, and we've simply done it on the basis of the momentum behind that silly advisor's words. This is not a silly advisor on the shore. This is the Lord of glory, the resurrected Jesus. There's an authority that compels them to do the absurd. And it's then that I think something is triggered in their heads. I think Jesus' words unconsciously, at this stage still, triggered something in them. I think this is maybe like Pavlov's dogs. They've heard this before, so they simply obey, still not recognizing that it's Jesus on the shore. Notice how Jesus speaks. Verse 4 again. Just as the day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" This isn't the first time that Jesus had addressed his disciples this way. It also wasn't the first time the disciples had had someone tell them to do the apparently illogical when it came to fishing. It's happened before. Again, to note down, Luke chapter 5 is the earlier occasion. You can look it up in your own time. But the issue is this: was a penny beginning to drop? Simply obeying. There's a sequence of developments here in verses 1 through 14, a logical sequence. Back to the question. I hope this isn't getting tedious. Is this the last point? It is my last point to note. Sixthly and lastly, how does the risen Jesus reveal himself to his people? Well, sixthly and lastly, he never comes, and note I've dropped the word often. I used the word often, scrupulously, in all five previous points. I'm dropping it now. Sixthly and lastly, he never comes without blessing us unexpectedly, but generously or satisfyingly in some way. Let me repeat that. He never comes without blessing us unexpectedly, but generously and satisfyingly in a way that fills the tummy, as it were, and not just the physical one, but the tummy of the soul. Without blessing us unexpectedly, but generously or satisfyingly in some way. We're talking about first, under the sixth point, first, about forms of blessing that finally blow his cover. Or rather, shake us out of our blindness. And then we're also talking, secondly, about forms of blessing in addition that remind us of what a wonderful, down-to-earth but heavenly Savior he is. And both of those elements are recorded in verses 6 to 14. All right? Without necessarily quoting, first of all, in apparently, or rather in doing the apparently useless, you know, that's putting the net, those boats weren't small. They were bigger than the rowing boats we hire down at Richmond Riverside, but they weren't big either. Okay? In doing the apparently useless, and that after a fruitless night, what happens? The seven men unexpectedly caught so many fish, they couldn't get them into the boat. That in itself is proof of the size of the catch. But noting the size of the fish and then counting them on the shore, we won't read it again, that drove home the point. Jesus was there. Do we ever sing this old song? I can't remember singing it. When upon life's billows you are tempest-tossed, when you are discouraged, thinking all is lost, count your many blessings, name them one by one, and it will surprise you what the Lord hath done. This big catch of fish, large fish, 153 of them. They had to be counted. So that's the first part of it, isn't it? Unexpectedly being blessed. But then second, that miracle of a massive catch of fish, as staggering as it was then followed by something better. And that was a hearty breakfast with the Lord. Let's quickly pull together everything we've seen. Because we repeatedly tie ourselves up in knots, don't we, when life doesn't go as we expect it to. Our disappointment, our depression is often directly proportional to the gap between what we expect and what is. Put it another way, our confusion, our disappointment, our depression largely stems from ignorance. Ignorance of the Lord's ways. And he revealed himself in this way. How does the risen Jesus, the risen Christ, appear to his people? Well, initially, he often appears unrecognized. And that in the normal humdrum and even frustrating of life, the humdrum and frustrating associated with the place where he has put us to wait. Wait for him to return from glory and usher in glory. He also often appears incognito, I should say, unrecognized. He appears issuing somewhat unexpected commands, doesn't he? Obedience to which does what? Yield unexpected and totally undeserved blessing. Blessing which tells us in unambiguous terms that He is near. Then, less miraculously, but more meaningfully, less miraculously, but more meaningfully, and a lot more generously, He serves us up with hearty breakfasts. And best of all, better than what's on the plate, He gives us Himself. Am I talking nonsense, brothers and sisters? Tell me no. It's in the text and we know it, don't we, brothers and sisters? It's in the text. This is the way He shows up. This is the way He appears. This is the way, more often than not, that He meets us. In the humdrum, the disappointing, the frustrating, the illogical. Waiting for Jesus is full of restless uncertainty, is it? Isn't it, rather? Isn't it? Poor old Peter. Poor old Peter, he gets a real hammering. He gets put in a headlock by the commentators. He gets a hammering from some preachers, commentators, Bible experts. What's he doing going fishing, they ask, when he's supposed to be waiting? Well, I ask, what else was he supposed to do while he was waiting? Go hungry? And it's when Peter and the others did the natural, the normal in their situation, waiting for Jesus because they needed to do something, as we all need to do. It's in that that Jesus comes. And that's the issue. That is the issue. This is the norm. It isn't the exception, it is the norm. Jesus comes in the restless uncertainty of mundane living, simply doing what He's told us to do, even when it seems illogical or even absurd, given the claims on our time and the glory that will come. I'm talking about things like praying to and worshiping an unseen God, who we believe exists and rewards those who seek Him. Are there better evidences of faith than that? All right? Praying to the unseen, along with, of course, simply entrusting our never-dying souls and lives to His faithful care. And then being faithful in little things, things we often imagine aren't that important, but are. The best and the biggest things that have ever happened in my life on an earthly level have come by simply obeying the mundane in life, trusting the Lord for outcomes and trusting Him to reveal Himself when He wants bless us and as He wants to bless us. I messed that all up, but I think you followed me. I, Simon Doyle, might have had to wait for blessing, but when it came, it was always worth it. Always worth it. And should Christ's way, this way, as John and the Spirit of God in him call it, should this way surprise us? Not given the stage in redemptive history we are in. We're battling, brothers and sisters, towards final victory. We cannot expect home country comforts until, of course, we're either called home early discharge from the front, right? Or victory is won through Christ's return. Until then, and we need to remember this, we obey orders and we live with the radio silence. We're battling towards victory. We have his instructions. We know what we need to do. We know exactly where we're heading, what's going to happen. We can live with the radio silence. But, as the disciples experienced, but, and we do, and we relish those occasions when the Lord comes with a refreshing and a heartening revelation of himself, as often as he is pleased to do it. We're going to end now. Again, a cappella. 757. O Jesus, I have promised to serve thee to the end. Be thou forever near me, my master and my friend. And let's hope I get the tune for this right and the correct starting note. Oh, Jesus, I have promised to serve thee to the end. Let's start from the beginning.